From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this week we learn, today we learn, one city is getting an Olympics. Beijing will host the Winter Olympics in 2022.
Beijing, of course, hosted the Summer Games back in 2008. It'll be the first city to host both the Summer and Winter Olympics. And the news today is raising a lot of questions, in part because Beijing doesn't get much snow. The BBC's John Sudworth joins us from Beijing. And John, what's the reaction there?
Well, from where I was standing, Jeremy, a pretty exuberant reaction. I'm outside the Bird's Nest Stadium, that iconic symbol, of course, of the 2008 Olympics. And the crowd gathered here were watching the announcement on a giant screen. Although it's probably worth saying it wouldn't be quite right to call it a spontaneous reaction. The public, who are normally allowed into this area, were cleared out. And what you could only call, really, professional cheering squads were bussed in. And some people, I suppose, might suggest that pretty much sums up Beijing's bid. You know, well-funded, but ultimately with this somewhat troubling democratic deficit at the heart of it.
But the other question that a lot of people are asking is, wait a minute, does Beijing even have snow? Is it a place where there should be a Winter Olympics?
Yeah, that is the other big concern, certainly for environmentalists, that, you know, this is a semi-arid region already suffering from drought, and these games will put a huge ecological impact onto this area. The big concern, of course, is that these games will need to rely very heavily on large volumes of artificially created snow. Now, Beijing says some of the resort areas, the resort of Chongli, for example, which is a couple of hundred kilometres north of here, will have enough snow. That does get at least some significant snowfall each year. And what it doesn't have, it will have to make. It admits that, and it says it can do it by piping in water from elsewhere. And there really ought to be no environmental concern, but it was a big question, I think, and the rival bid, the Kazakhstan bid, the city of Almaty, was making something of it. They were calling themselves the real choice, which I think a lot of observers saw as a bit of a dig at the fact that Beijing doesn't have enough of its own snow for what a lot of people would think the amounts you'd need to have to host a successful Winter Olympics.
And John, I know that you had a little experience when you went looking for snow at a ski resort north of Beijing. What happened?
Yeah, really interesting this, actually. We went up to Chongli, drove up there, and of course, as a foreign correspondent in China, it's not unusual to get a bit of attention as we go about our business. But you wouldn't have thought, you know, a pretty routine trip to a ski resort ahead of the announcement this week would attract much attention. But in fact, we were picked up along the route somewhere. We noticed we were being tailed not long after leaving Beijing, and these, you know, shadowy cars with tinted windows, stayed with us all day, following us all around this resort area, stopping when we stopped to fill, moving on again when we moved on. At one point, I knocked on the window and asked them who they were and why they were following us. They refused to answer that question. They denied they were tailing us. You know, it may be a sign of perhaps an over-anxious local security bureau ahead of this announcement, but it could also, of course, be interpreted as a sign that China doesn't necessarily have the kind of commitment to the sorts of rights and freedoms some people suggest it should have when signing up to this kind of very large, very high-profile international event.
Well, and of course, this announcement comes just days after we learned that Boston will not have the U.S. bid for 2024 for the Summer Olympics, in large part because taxpayers didn't want to put up the money if there were cost overruns. And you look at the 2022 Olympics, and this was a choice between China and Kazakhstan, two countries with very questionable human rights records and not a lot of respect for the views of the people on things like cost overruns.
Well, that's right. Human rights campaigners were suggesting that the choice that the International Olympic Committee had to make today was between what they're dubbing the dismal duo. A lot of people worried that ultimately it may be only authoritarian regimes that don't have to show themselves accountable to the public that can stump up the sorts of money and the kinds of investment necessary. In the end, China's economic and political clout won out. And what it was telling the International Olympic Committee is what it told them back in 2008, that, you know, whatever the concerns are on that level, this will be an opportunity to invite the outside world in, to showcase China. And of course, they are saying on the issue of sporting legacy, they can offer something very special, the chance to introduce 1.3 billion people to Winter Olympic sport.
Well, and actually, we went back and looked and found that the last time that one city hosted the Olympics so close together, and this will be a 14-year period, 2008 and 2022, the last time that happened was Athens, 1896 and 1906.
Yeah, there you go. Not many gold medal winners left alive from any of those competitions. Ultimately, I think what they really see in this is a development opportunity. It will come, for example, with a high-speed rail link up to that northern resort area, cutting the journey time to the big city up there from something like 3 or 4 hours at present to less than an hour. They really see this as an opportunity, and perhaps at the end of the day, more democratic countries in Europe and America, North America, may not need that sort of development boost. China says it does, and certainly I think we'll see in state media over the next day or two a real appreciation and real applause, as you'd expect, of course, but I think nonetheless, most of it pretty genuine.
The BBC's John Sudworth speaking with us from Beijing, which will be hosting the 2022 Winter Games. John, thank you.
Pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, yesterday, here at home, the Obama administration released an updated national strategy to prevent and treat HIV and AIDS, and parts of it focus specifically on how to treat infections in minority communities and the South. For instance, the Atlanta metro area has one of the highest rates in the country for new diagnoses. Sean Powers from Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
It's about 1:30 in the morning in Atlanta's old 4th Ward. It's the weekend, and lots of people are going in and coming out of the neighborhood's many bars. Gary Jerkins of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation is out there in front of a large HIV testing van. He's passing out condoms and candy.
So we pass out lifesavers, and we tell people that the test can be a lifesaver. We pass out dum-dums, and we say, don't be a dum-dum, know your status. And we pass out Smarties. Smarties get tested, know your status.
Jerkins says knowing your HIV status is good, whether positive or negative, if it means halting the spread of the disease. 23-year-old Lamar Yarborough remembers his diagnosis. It was on his 18th birthday.
2 days before my birthday, I fainted in the shower, and my mother, she rushed me to the hospital. They told me that I had AIDS.
Yarborough says the virus was sexually transmitted. He had been sleeping with both men and women. He also developed a type of cancer tied to HIV. He says within his family, talk about sex was confined to heterosexual relationships. Sex ed in school wasn't much better. Now he's more vocal about the importance of being able to tell someone how to handle HIV.
You don't have a lot of people who are advocates, who are African-American men that I've seen, you know, growing up. We are dying from this. And so therefore, it makes me step up to the plate and say I need to be a leader.
Death from AIDS is still a reality for many young African-Americans. Dr. Abigail Hinken-Way oversees the HIV testing program at Grady Hospital, where Lamar Yarborough was diagnosed.
We've had patients who were diagnosed on the first same visit that they died of their complications. Obviously not the way we should be doing it in 2015.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the South has the greatest number of people living with and dying from the disease. The CDC says the South makes up about half of all cases of people who have died from AIDS. In Georgia, 613 people died in 2012. Emory University researcher Patrick Sullivan used to oversee HIV surveillance at the CDC. He says black men who have sex with other men in Atlanta are 3 times more likely to become HIV positive than whites, and that's despite having a similar number of sex partners.
That finding was related to 2 things. One was they had more black partners. Those black partners are more likely to be living with HIV. And the other, access to health insurance.
Medicaid is the largest source of coverage for persons living with HIV and AIDS, says Nick Carlisle of the Southern AIDS Coalition. Carlisle says not expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which is the case in Georgia and most southern states, keeps some people from getting tested.
So many people are being diagnosed late, and I think that's one of the signs of not having access to routine health care.
For those already diagnosed with HIV, there is a safety net. It's the federal Ryan White Care Act. And Carlisle says it is available to people who are HIV positive and don't have any health coverage.
But that safety net is vulnerable. It's subject to appropriations every year, and if and when the Ryan White Care Act goes away and Medicaid hasn't been expanded, you're talking about a disaster for people living with HIV in the South.
Lamar Yarborough, who was diagnosed with AIDS on his 18th birthday, relies on the Ryan White Care Act to cover the cost of his antiretroviral medication. He's unemployed and doesn't qualify for Medicaid in Georgia.
If Ryan White ever went away, then hopefully, God willing, you know, I will be financially stable to pay for them myself.
Georgia's Department of Public Health reports that there's a disproportionate share of the more than 50,000 people with HIV in the state who are like Lamar Yarborough, low income and Black. But Yarborough doesn't consider AIDS a death sentence. He says he feels good. He's taking his medication, and this summer he started a support group to help youth and young adults living with HIV. For Here and Now, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
It's Here and Now, and we're still waiting to find out if the piece of debris found on an island in the Indian Ocean is from Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, the plane that disappeared last year with 239 people on board. For the last 17 months, there has been an extensive search for the plane and numerous theories about what happened. It was just one of the many unsolved mysteries that captivate our imagination. Paul Aaron is director of publications at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. He's author of several books about unsolved historical mysteries, and he's with us from Williamsburg, Virginia. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, this disappearance of this plane is obviously a huge tragedy for the people on board and their loved ones, but it also has captured the attention of people around the world who want to know every detail about, you know, what we know about where this plane might be. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's something fascinating about any disappearance. And aviation disappearances seem to be especially intriguing. This is not the first plane to disappear. I mean, probably the most famous disappearance of the 20th century would have been Amelia Earhart. And
right.
People are still trying to figure out what happened to her.
Her plane vanished over the ocean in July of 1937. But we did just find a piece of her plane in 2014, right?
We did just find a piece of her plane. Well, at least there are claims. Rick Gillespie, who is one of the leading, has been for decades searching for the plane, believes, and his group, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, believes that he has found part of the plane. Not all experts agree. I mean, Gillespie has in the past made a case for having found part of the plane. At one point, he found part of a woman's shoe in a size and style that Earhart wore. And at another point, he found a navigator's bookcase with screw holes that suggested it had been installed in a plane. But there are those who question those finds. Shoes might have gotten there by other means than Earhart's feet, and same for all sorts of flotsam and jetsam. So he is certainly a reputable researcher, but not everyone agrees. It remains an unsolved mystery.
It remains an unsolved mystery I remember being brought up wondering whether her plane vanished because of the Bermuda Triangle. Of course, that's impossible because she disappeared in the Pacific.
It was the Pacific, but right. There are all sorts of intriguing stories. I mean, one of the most intriguing theories is that Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, were spies, that the round-the-world trip was actually a cover for taking pictures of Japanese fortifications. And one of the theories about her disappearance is that the Japanese forced Earhart down and took them prisoner or executed them. That actually originated not with a historian, but in a 1943 movie starring Rosalind Russell and Fred McMurray. But I think the consensus among historians remains that whatever happened to her, she probably was not a spy. That was not, at least most of her biographers who knew her best, really point to other reasons she would have had to fly around the world besides to spy on the Japanese. I mean, there were lucrative endorsement possibilities, and she just loved flying.
Well, and you make the point that we often look for a very complicated answers to questions when we are talking about a disappearance, when in fact the answer may be something very simple.
Absolutely. And that's true for a lot of historical mysteries. It's true for a lot of other aviation mysteries. I mean, if you look at some of the other aviation mysteries that still intrigue us, there are those who believe – there's the question of whether FDR knew in advance about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And conspiracy theorists have argued, and some continue to argue, that because he was eager to get us into World War II, because there was such strong isolationist sentiment in the United States, that though he knew in advance the attack on Pearl Harbor, he did not notify his commanders in order to have the disaster of Pearl Harbor that would lead America into the war. But there, too, as you point out, there are simpler explanations. I mean, if you are preparing to fight the Japanese, it's a lot easier to fight the Japanese without
letting them attack
Pearl Harbor. without your Navy under, you know, sunk. Right. There are simpler explanations. It's not that conspiracy theories are never right, but often they are more convoluted than other explanations.
We're speaking with Paul Aaron, who's the author of several books about unsolved historical mysteries. And Paul, I think we'd have to put Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance on the list of some of the biggest unsolved mysteries.
Yes, if his body was found, that would certainly be headline news. His disappearance was July 30th, 1975. So that was just, 40 years ago yesterday. And people have looked for his body or suspected his body would be found in all sorts of garbage dumps, and most famously under the end zone of the Meadowlands football stadium in New Jersey. But it has never been found. There are numerous conspiracy theories. Castro and Kennedy are all entangled. So the Kennedy assassination and the Hoffa assassination are often linked. One theory goes that the mafia killed JFK to avenge RFK's anti-organized crime efforts, and then the mafia killed Hoffa because he knew about the plot to kill JFK. And there are all sorts of intriguing links. Jack Ruby, who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, was the number two man in a Teamster affiliate run by a friend of Hoffa. But again, the conspiracy theorists, there is logic to them, but there's no hard evidence, and this is another case where there are simpler theories. I mean, the FBI has always maintained that Hoffa was killed by the mob because after Hoffa got out of jail, he was making noises about a comeback. And the mob leaders preferred working with Frank Fitzsimmons, who had replaced him. The mob decided they didn't want Hoffa coming back. They decided to get rid of him. Again, though, it's an unsolved mystery. I mean, the FBI has never been able to get a conviction. There were certainly mob figures who they believed were involved in killing Hoffa. Anthony Provenzano was one. He feuded with Hoffa in jail, but he had airtight alibis.
Well, I want to get to one more unsolved mystery while we have you here, Paul Aaron, that you had brought to our attention, which is in your neck of the woods, in 1587, when English settlers arrived on North Carolina's Roanoke Island, and then they disappeared in 1590. What do people think happened?
That is certainly a classic mystery. They landed on Roanoke Island in July 87. Governor John White, who stayed for the birth of his granddaughter, then sailed back to England for supplies. And when he returned, they were all gone. 90 men, 17 women. 9 children just vanished. The solutions, I mean, there have been a range of solutions proposed, that they tried to get back to England and were lost at sea. But the problem with that theory is they didn't really have a large enough boat to cross the Atlantic. Another theory was that they were killed by Spaniards. But Spanish documents still show Spanish ships looking for the colony as late as 1600. The consensus among most historians is that they either joined the Indians or were killed by Indians, or perhaps joined and then were later killed by Indians. The Jamestown settlers who arrived in 1607 had all sorts of reports from Indians of people in the area who looked like them, who were white. And the theory that they were – well, one theory goes that they joined the Indians and were killed just before – the Jamestown settlers arrived, perhaps by Powhatan, who was the chief and Pocahontas' father, who, as John Smith and the Jamestown settlers arrived, thought, you know, this is too many people, too many white people here. And at that point, though, they had been, the Roanoke lost colonists had been living peacefully among them. Powhatan killed them. That's at least one theory that would explain the stories of lost colonists in the area and also the failure of the Jamestown settlers to find them.
And are there still people that are looking for them?
There are absolutely still people who are looking, and it's not inconceivable that archaeologists may someday find more evidence. I mean, even just earlier this week, archaeologists at Jamestown announced that they had identified the remains of four leaders. In one grave, there were some Catholic relics, which indicated that maybe one of the people at the leaders at Jamestown was a Spanish spy. So you make these new discoveries, but then there are new mysteries that they raise, and you know there are all sorts of revolutionary mysteries from the period right around here, right around Williamsburg. Did Patrick Henry really say, "If this be treason, make the most of it"? Or other, who fired the first shot at Lexington and Concord? Or
right.
What were the, you know, one could go on. Did Betsy Ross design the flag? Did Sally Hemings give birth to children of Jefferson? There's always new evidence. But what I find so exciting about historical mysteries, you have these twists and turns, you have dead ends, you have intellectual challenges, and you get closer and closer to a solution, but there are always new mysteries. That's what makes history fun.
That's Paul Aaron, the director of publications at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. He's author of several books about unsolved mysteries. We'd love to hear your unsolved mysteries at our website, hereandnow.org. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Google Glass is attempting a comeback. Several news organizations are reporting on a 2.0 version of the wearable computing device, an update that will be called the Enterprise Edition and marketed exclusively for the workplace. The original Google Glass was a flop with consumers, but the healthcare industry is still experimenting with it. Prachi Patel from our tech partner IEEE Spectrum visited a Pennsylvania hospital to see how trauma surgeons are using Google Glass.
Things happen quickly at trauma centers, like this one at Forbes Hospital in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. When medics rush patients in, a dozen medical professionals burst into action.
We will examine her, we will check her vital signs, we'll check her pulses, we will hook her up to EKG and oxygen monitors, and it happens all at once so we can do that as quickly as possible.
That's Christoph Kaufmann. He's director of the trauma center here. Along with treating and resuscitating the patient, trauma surgeons like Kaufmann are also team leaders. That means making sure every little step, from calling for a CT scan or administering narcotics, is happening at the right time.
And in the midst of trying to save the patient's life, some of those level issues, like did you send off the blood work, did you start antibiotics, did you call the operating room to tell them we might need to come up with this patient?
Those logistics can be hard to keep track of. So Kaufmann and a few other surgeons have started to use Google Glass to get timely reminders. Google Glass is an eyeglass frame with a built-in computer. A tiny camera and display wrap around the top of one lens. The screen sort of floats in the air on the upper right corner of the lens. The camera on Kaufmann's glass is covered for patient privacy. He gave me a demo by attaching the glass screen to his smartphone display.
And now I can look up and down this list of things that it will tell me. I have a trauma team leader application. I have setting up a blood transfusion device. I have an ICU checklist.
The screen shows checklists set up like PowerPoint slides. Kaufmann tips his head up and down to scroll the screen. And he taps the glass or uses voice commands to activate it and select options.
Okay, glass. Start trauma eval. And now you can see a clock is starting and it's counting. 4 seconds, 5 seconds, and it asks that we have taken the history of the patient, IV access, tell the team, and about every 3 minutes it will provide a new prompt, and we can see that come up about then.
Kaufmann says the display isn't distracting. He compares the Google Glass reminders to the written checklists pilots use before takeoff and landing.
doctors don't have the ability to have a piece of paper or checklist or to be holding an iPad and looking at a checklist. We need our hands to be resuscitating the patient and providing patient care. And we like to say that trauma surgeons are the fighter pilots of the medical world.
Kaufman has been using Google Glass for more than 6 months now. There are some snags with the technology. The battery only lasts an hour and takes 2 hours to charge. And the glass occasionally overheats. But Kaufman says patients have responded positively, and he believes this is just the start.
I realize that what I would be looking at through the Google Glass is the future, and what I'm seeing is the future of medicine.
And so 20 years from now, every doctor helping patients might be talking to their smart glasses for assistance. For Here and Now, this is Prachi Patil.
And Prachi's story comes to us from our tech partners, IEEE Spectrum.
The new film, The End of the Tour, opens today in New York and Los Angeles. It tells the story of a road trip the late David Foster Wallace took with a young reporter in 1996. At the time, Wallace was riding a wave of fame as arguably the most popular writer on the planet after publishing his massive novel, Infinite Jest. The new film stars Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace and Jesse Eisenberg as the young reporter.
When I think of this trip, I see David and me in the front seat of his car. He wants something better than he has. I want precisely what he has already.
David. Wallace, welcome to Minneapolis.
Hi, I'm David Lipsky.
Oh,
how are you?
Hi. Okay, David and David.
We only just met. He's writing a piece on the tour. What's this story about in your mind?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country, that sort of thing.
You're like a nervous guy, huh?
No. I'm okay. How are you?
Because I'm terrified.
I gotta ask, what is with the bandana?
I know that it's a security blanket for me whenever I'm kind of afraid my head is gonna explode. If we ate like this all the time, what would be wrong with that?
It's like good seductive commercial entertainment, like Die Hard.
First Die Hard? Great film.
Yes. No, it's a brilliant
film. The best.
Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace, ending that trailer there for the new film, The End of the Tour. The tour was the final leg of Wallace's book tour for Infinite Jest in 1996. The reporter with him was Rolling Stone's David Lipsky, who went to Wallace's hometown of Bloomington, Illinois, to join him for that last leg and write a profile. The profile was never published, but after Wallace killed himself in 2008, David Lipsky went back to his tapes and transcripts from that week he spent with a writer and put that material into a book called Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace, and that inspired the new film. We spoke with David Lipsky in 2010 and started by asking him to put the trip into context. It was 1996. David Foster Wallace was a rock star. Besides Infinite Jest, there were essays like A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again about going on a cruise ship for Harper's Magazine. It just knocked people out. And we asked David why. What was the reaction?
I think they reacted the way people reacted in the 50s when they first read Salinger. It was kind of when you opened up a magazine to read one of his essays, instead of finding words, it was like finding a kind of mirror. I remember that at the time that Infinite Jest came out, I was at a party, and a woman sat down next to me and looked at all the aspiring and successful writers in the room and said, every relationship in this room is being ruined by David Foster Wallace. Because when he's in the paper, the women are like, ah, David Foster Wallace is so cute. And the guys are like, I want to be David Foster Wallace. So it was just this incredible joy about a new writer. And then this, here's this guy who's done what everyone wanted to do.
And what is that? Can you try to put your finger on it? You know, the cruise ship piece, people faxing it to each other, reading it out loud over the phone. It told of, you know, it's simple concept. He's taking a trip on a luxury cruise. What was it about his writing?
What David talks about in his work is that writing is the thing that allows us to not feel lonely. He's able to kind of capture your brain voice. Do you know the way your brain, you'll be thinking about what you're seeing, you'll be thinking about a movie line you liked, you'll be thinking about something you want to say to somebody else, and there are all those thoughts going at once. When he writes, he gets all that out in a very clean, very clear, very funny way, and suddenly you know what the sound of your own brain is, and that's a thrilling thing. There's no other writing like it.
For instance, he'd make an observation about the way people smile at you when they don't really mean it, and 3 pages later, he'd gone through 10 footnotes about, you know, phony smiles, and then, but you really want the smile. Why aren't they smiling at me? And it just...
Yeah, and then he ends with, what a damn mess.
All right. Infinite Jest. You want to try? You take a shot at what this huge book was about?
Sure. Infinite Jest is about everything, but it really is about how the world feels now. I mean, there are great stories about people in 12-step programs and people at a tennis academy. But the real thing it's about and why it was thrilling is it's about how it feels to live at a time when you're transacting a huge amount of your life through electronic data, when you're transacting a great deal of your connections with other people through electronic screens. It's about what it feels like to be alive now. Yeah. Again, there's no other book like it.
And here you are. Rolling Stone assigns you to do a profile on him. You spend 4 or 5 days with him. This was at the end of his book tour for Infinite Jest. You play chess. You get iced in at an airport. You sleep in his spare room. What did he say to you? His spare blanket is your spare blanket. You watch him with his dogs that he loves. You eat with him at Denny's and McDonald's. You record all this. So when you go back to listen to it, and you also wrote a profile in Rolling Stone in 2008, who did you hear? Who'd you find?
His writing is as funny and charming as alive as any writing I've ever read. In person, he was like that, too. He was just completely shockingly awake. Like, when we checked into the hotel in Minneapolis, the woman at the desk said to me, you know, and your room has two twins. And David said, yes, Anita and Consuela. We walked into a Denny's, and I was surprised there was a smoking section. And David said, yes, there's even a chain-smoking section at Denny's. I remember we were at Mall of America, and we were looking around. It was he was a really funny person to be at Mall of America with, because he was looking at the store names. And he looked across, and there was a restaurant called Hulk Hogan's Pasta Mania. And he said, when I think pasta, I think Hulk Hogan. I'm sorry, I blew the line.
No, that's great. Was that the line? Okay. I mean,
yeah, that's the line. Just a brilliant, brilliant mind, incredibly fast, and incredibly funny and cheerful. Just because if you can take in all that information, somehow it's going to make you cheerful, I think, too. And that is what I want to capture in the book.
But there's also a whole stretch. You're both exhausted from the tour, and he just seems to spill his guts. He tells you about how when an earlier book that he'd written, I think it was his second, when it tanked, he became suicidal. He talked about when he was at Harvard and went into McLean's psychiatric hospital. In essence, what we're hearing there is, you know, Infinite Jest might not have been written. As sad as the real ending is, it was almost sadder.
To me, the amazing thing about him going into McLean in 1989 is that within a year or two of that, he has himself stable. He begins working on the novel in 1992, and he's done by 95. And to me, part of what's really very inspiring about having gotten to live this time with him again is remembering just what an amazing feat that is to bring off, to have thought, you know, he said at the time after he had gone into McLean that he thought his life was over, he thought he was done. And then 6 years later to write what is the best novel by anyone of his generation. It's just an amazing thing. It shows just how strong he was, too.
In looking back and listening back, you know, in these beginnings of a story, did you see the end? Is there a point where you said, oh, I wish I'd done this or done that? Or no, because, you know, he's so open about his depression. It's not as if this was a secret.
David had kept secret that he was on antidepressants, which came out after his death. Towards the end of his life, David tried to switch medications at the advice of some of his doctors, and it was a bad drug reaction that really led to his suicide. It wasn't the pressure of being a writer, and it wasn't the pressure of his senses that drove him to take his own life. It was, in many ways, very clearly just a medical reaction. If you had asked me in August of 2008 who the most healthy American writer is, I would have said without hesitation, David Foster Wallace.
In fact, we have a passage from your conversations. Remember, this is a 14-year-old cassette tape. It's towards the end of the time you spent together, these several days. Let's listen.
If you can think of times in your life that you've treated people with extraordinary decency and love and pure, uninterested concern just because they were valuable as human beings, the ability to do that with ourselves, to treat ourselves the way we would treat a really good, precious friend, or a tiny child of ours that we absolutely love more than life itself. And I think it's probably possible to achieve that. I think part of the job we're here for is to learn how to do it.
David, what do you take from that?
That's the voice of somebody who was extremely intelligent and extremely warm, trying to decide, trying to pick a way to live. I mean, it really brings me back to being there in his little house in Bloomington. But it's also part of what makes him so special as a writer is that not only is he seeing life clearly, he kind of gives readers, he gives me as a reader, a sense of ways I might try to live, too.
Well, David Lipsky, before we let you go, just tell us something else that David Foster Wallace told you about writing?
I mean, he had a really clear idea of what writing was supposed to be. He said that he liked writing that worked on your nerve endings. And he said that with real writing, there was a kind of stomach magic. He said that it's so much fun to read, I'd rather read right now than eat.
Yeah.
He was talking, it was very funny. He saw kind of what makes some people uncomfortable now about things like Facebook or about Twitter or about IMing and texting each other. He said that technology would get better and better at doing what it does, which is leaving us alone in front of screens, and that we were going to have to invent some machinery inside our guts to help us deal with that. I think of that every day because I haven't, and most people I know haven't quite done that gut-building machinery. You know, we haven't done that gut-building work yet.
That's David Lipsky. We spoke in 2010 about his book, Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace. It inspired the new film, The End of the Tour, which opens in some cities today. This week, a parole board decided that Jonathan Pollard will be released from prison in November, 30 years after he provided Israel with confidential U.S. intelligence he stole while working for the Navy. His supporters, including Israeli officials who admit he spied for them, have long said his sentence was too harsh and his knowledge now useless. His critics say he violated the country's trust and he's still a threat with a photographic memory of damaging information. And now, some say his release is just to placate Israel in light of the Iran deal, which the Obama administration denies. Ronald Olive is a former member of the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. He investigated the Pollard case. So, Ron, what exactly did Jonathan Pollard do?
For 18 months, Jonathan Pollard spied for Israel. 2 to 3 times a day during the week, he would gather up top-secret material, put it in his briefcase out of our headquarters in Suitland, Maryland, walk out the door, get in his car, and take that material, park, put it in the trunk, and come back. 2 or 3 days a week, 2 or 3 times a day, he would steal these documents, take them home, and prepare them to give to Israel at a safe house. When they did a damage assessment after he was arrested, they found out that if they would stack what he stole, it would be 6 foot wide, 6 foot high, and 10 feet long, close to well over a million documents he gave to the Israelis.
Well, and by the way, his trial captivated people. He and his wife, his first wife, was involved with this. They used
They used
language like, we have to meet with the cactus people. This enthralled people at the time.
Yeah, cactus was a code word. And when we went to interrogate Pollard, he told his wife, because there was a lot of spies being caught at this time around 1984, 1985. It was incredible. And he was afraid. So on a Sunday night, he tells his wife that if I ever in any way use the word cactus with you on the phone, you know I am in trouble and you need to get all of our highly classified documents out of our apartment and get rid of them.
His wife was given a 5-year sentence. But this was just a fiery time, and it captured the imagination. But his supporters say, first of all, he never should have been in Navy intelligence. He had drug problems, allegedly. He was kind of an odd character. And that Israel was our ally. So it's not as if he was sending information to an enemy. That's their case for wanting to lessen his charges. You say what?
I say, first of all, what he did to our country and the quantity and the quality of the information he stole was at the highest classification level. Jonathan Pollard stole top-secret, sensitive compartment information from almost every intelligence outfit in Washington, D.C.
Then, over the next several decades, he became a bargaining chip in just about every peace talks that or negotiation that Israel and the U.S. were involved in. We're thinking of when then President Clinton, was involved in Mideast peace talks. There was a deal completely signed, sealed, and almost delivered, and at the last second, Prime Minister Netanyahu, his first go-round as prime minister, in the very last second said, oh, and I want Jonathan Pollard released. How much has he been this kind of bargaining chip for the last several decades?
He has been a bargaining chip, I would say, for the last 30 years. That Y Plantation conference, you know, Yasser Arafat was there too. When President Clinton was going to go along with Yasser Arafat, And the bargaining chip with Netanyahu was Jonathan Pollard. And a lot of people don't know the story that when George Tenet, who was the director of the CIA at the time, heard that President Clinton was going to release him immediately, I mean, he got in touch with President Clinton, and I talked to George Tenet. He said to the President of the United States, if you release Jonathan Pollard without going through the entire intelligence community, I will give you my resignation immediately. Hmm. President Clinton, like, whoa, this must really be serious. So he backed down from that. That was a good move on his part.
He's being released now, the administration says, not because it has anything to do with the ongoing deal with Iran and Israel's objection to that deal, but because the mandatory limit in the sentence has been reached, 30 years, and the parole board took the case up. But do you think that he's still dangerous?
Jonathan Pollard is a very intelligent individual. And, you know, people say, well, it's been 30 years. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that still is classified. I can't prove it, but I can imagine that he still has a lot of information, whether it would be changed over this amount of time, yes, but some things don't change.
Well, that's the opinion of Ronald Olive, former member of the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, which led the investigation into Jonathan Pollard's espionage case, also author of Capturing Jonathan Pollard, How One of the Most Notorious Spies in American History Was Brought to Justice. It's really quite a fascinating story. Ron, thanks for sharing your view of it.
You're quite welcome. Thank you very much.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.